Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Ximena Gutierrez from Glenwood Springs High School and Sabrina Turbidy, Aspen High School, both rising seniors. They will be interviewing Lucy Caldwell from Cambridge University. Lucy Caldwell is a fellow and chemist at Clare College, Cambridge. She completed a BA in mathematics at Cambridge and a PhD in applied mathematics at Harvard, followed by membership at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Her website says, "Across the natural sciences, ongoing technological advances enable ever-increasing numbers of variables to be measured during single experiments. It is of crucial importance that we develop analytical techniques to extract useful information from these data sets, which are typically large and highly undersampled, placing them outside the realm of standard statistical analysis. Lucy's research develops methods that use these large data sets from high throughput experiments to construct theories that relate genotype, i.e., sequence to the phenotype, or function of a molecule, focusing on proteins, small molecules, and nucleic acids. This is going to be a challenging and very interesting interview.
Hi, Lucy. When did you decide you wanted to go into the physics career and industry?
So I guess actually when I was really quite young, I was really interested in mathematics. And so I studied a lot of math when I was pretty young, I guess even before sort of 11 or 12, and I really enjoyed it. And I basically also wanted a career where I would be able to discover things. And I think what's really nice about being an academic is that you can work on the questions that you choose to work on. And as long as you can get support from your peers in academia, you have a lot of freedom, a lot of intellectual freedom. And so I suppose, you know, even when I was quite young, I somehow knew that was the case. And I just really, really wanted to make that possible for me in my career.
So when you went to college to study your major, did you pick mathematics or physics?
I actually picked mathematics, but at Cambridge, mathematics and theoretical physics are in the same department. And so I knew actually when I went to college that I didn't really want to do experiments because I was really not very good at experiments. And so I was anxious to avoid that. And so the maths degree, the math degree at Cambridge means you do a lot of theoretical physics, but you never do any experiments. And so that really worked well for me.
And then also going into the subjects matter, you work with biochemistry, physics, math. How does that all intertwine with your work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I actually stopped studying biology and chemistry in school when I was 16. So I was pretty focused on doing sort of math and physics, and it never really occurred to me that I would end up, I'm actually in a chemistry department at Cambridge, which is really surprising because, yeah, I stopped when I was 16. I didn't do any chemistry in college at all. Because in England, when you go to college, you pick your major and that's all you study. And so it was really a surprise that I ended up doing this. And I suppose it was just that the problems were really interesting and a lot of data was becoming available in this area. So that made it sort of possible to make a lot of progress.
Have you met any people through your past that have really influenced your work?
That's a good question. Have I met any people? So I suppose when I was at college at Cambridge, I was a mathematician. And so, you know, so I've interacted a lot with a lot of really quite pure mathematicians. And what they do is very elegant and very beautiful. I guess I found it difficult to understand how it really impacted the real world. And it does impact the real world. It's just sort of on a much longer timescale to people who do applied math. So I suppose, and that's a funny way in which people influence me, but it kind of, you know, I loved this subject, but interacting with pure mathematicians made me realize I wanted to do something that was really more applied and more real world. In terms of individuals, like I had a very influential advisor, or in fact, I had sort of two advisors when I was an undergrad, one of whom was a physicist and one of whom was a pure mathematician. They were both very helpful and encouraging. But what I ended up doing wasn't actually anything like what either of them do. So I suppose people sort of influence me and help me a lot. But I don't actually know that many people who do work that is similar to me. So I suppose I sort of, you know, I had people help and advise me, but I moved away from what they did very much. Does that?
That makes sense. So after college, what did you do? Did you start conducting your own research? Did you know you wanted to be a professor, or what?
So I really wanted to be a professor. In retrospect, I'm not totally sure why, because I think it was really the research aspect that attracted me rather than the teaching aspect. So now that I do the job, I actually really enjoy teaching and advising students. But when I was young, I just really wanted to do research. And it was clear to me that the way to do research was to like become a professor, essentially. So that's what motivated me. So after I finished my undergrad, I started a PhD at Cambridge in the applied math department, or the theoretical physics department at Cambridge, working with somebody who'd recently moved there. And in the end, curiously, that PhD didn't work out because my then advisor decided to leave the university. And so I sort of had this full start. Like I spent a year doing research and then had to sort of rethink everything after that year. So I knew it was what I wanted to do, but I just sort of took some time to find the right path.
So being a professor, what's the hardest task that you have to do dealing with students?
So I really like interacting with students. I think the hardest thing, I mean, giving lectures is difficult because you have to explain material that's, you know, often quite dry and, you know, not that necessarily interesting to all the students in your class in a way that like engages students and makes them sort of stay awake and enjoy it. Also, the students that I teach are natural scientists at Cambridge, so they have kind of a different background to me. They have a much, much more scientific background and much less mathematical background. And so I have to sort of be aware of that in my teaching. In a sense, I give these lecture courses at Cambridge where I have like 120 students in the course, and it's very impersonal. And I much prefer teaching in smaller groups where it's more interactive. So I find that quite challenging, like being on a stage and having to just, you know, orate. Like, yeah.
Are you working with any students in research currently?
Yeah, I am. I have a number of students in my research group, both PhD students and MPhil students. I have a couple of PhD students who are about to graduate. Curiously, my students have all been female, at least my PhD students, until now, which was sort of unexpected because I think there's definitely more male PhD students than female PhD students in the hard sciences. So it's been great to be able to sort of advise and mentor young women who are doing science. But it was just surprising that it worked out that way. But they've been great. The students are really, really, particularly research students, are really fantastic to work with.
So talking about women in the field, how have you felt welcome into this field? Like, are there a lot of other women you're working with?
I definitely can't say there's a lot of other women that I'm working with. Actually, the Aspen Center for Physics has been really great. So I've been coming here since I was a graduate student. I sort of came in the winter months when I was a graduate student, and more recently I've come in the summer. And it's been a really great way to sort of meet other physicists on a more informal basis. So that's been really helpful. I think, I mean, the field is very welcoming, but there are very few women, and that makes it difficult because I think you naturally interact more easily with people who kind of are more like you. And so, yeah, I've definitely found that sort of a challenge in some sense. I'm fortunate, like in my department, Another sort of young woman was hired at the same time as me. And so we've been able to sort of, talk to each other, you know, be friends essentially, as we go through the process of being young faculty. And so that's been really helpful. But I think, you know, it is a challenge and there is still a lot of progress to be made. And I think, you know, institutions like the Aspen Center for Physics can really make a big difference.
Yeah, so going back to the students and the research you're doing, what research are you currently conducting right now?
So actually I'm working on a project with a colleague of mine who's an organic chemist. And this is a big departure for me because I'm not an organic chemist in any sense. I'm learning a lot about different reactions and how they work, but this is very new for me. Basically, my colleague has developed a system that allows a lot of reactions to be carried out at the same time in parallel, so thousands of reactions. So it means you can collect a lot of data. And the question is how to interpret and understand that data. And so we're basically trying to make theories of chemistry, which is a bit crazy, and we don't exactly know what we're doing, but it's really interesting. So I always sort of had this idea that going into science, there would be a lot of problem solving and, you know, sort of you'd be able to, invent ideas and try them out and see if they really work. And this is a project where that's particularly true. Like, it's really fun. People haven't done this before because they haven't had access to that kind of data. And so it's sort of scary and at the same time really exciting.
So how did you decide you and your colleague were going to go into this project?
Well, basically, my colleague figured out over quite a lot of time, actually, how to generate this data. So it took a lot of work, a lot of engineering, tinkering with equipment, trying out, you know, lots of different sort of robots for doing pipetting and stuff like that. And he came to me and said, look, you know, we can generate all this data. We need to figure out what to do with it, basically. And so when someone comes to you and says that, it's a really exciting opportunity because, you know, it's something that hasn't been possible before. And so that's really what got me involved. But it has been a sort of an uphill struggle because I don't have a strong background in organic chemistry in any sense. So it's a very steep learning curve.
So I understand that you mostly like to do large data research. Mm-hmm. So why that?
Well, I think very pragmatically, that's the thing that has become available in the last 10, 20 years that really wasn't available before. And so when you're going into science, you know, there's been all these people who are really, really highly intelligent thinking about problems for a long time. And so it always seemed to me that it seemed most likely that I could make a contribution in a place where there was a new resource. So people hadn't been able to think about that problem before because, you know, the data wasn't there, right? And so that very much motivated me. I was very pragmatic. I just thought, well, you know, like, people have been working this problem for a long time. They're really clever. It's unlikely I'm going to be able to, you know, do something new in those places. Whereas, you know, if this is a really new area and problem, then it's like a frontier. So that was what motivated me. And I think, you know, the data that we have access to, you know, from a human genome project, from sequencing lots and lots of genomes, it really contains a mine of information, and we haven't figured out yet how to extract that information. So we're very good at collecting the data and putting it into databases and kind of, you know, storing it in a very organized fashion. And that's sort of, you know, that's been a lot of work. A lot of resource and expertise has gone into that. But the question of how to really understand the data is really difficult. It's a bit like people who work on the stock market. Right, they have tons and tons of data about stock prices and companies, and, you know, they're trying to put it all together to predict where stocks will go next, right? And the models that they work on are sort of sophisticated, and they still don't work that well. So it's a similar problem, right? We have all this data, and we just have to try and understand it.
So you've been talking about how you guys, I mean, like, really, there was a lack of information in the past where it's hard to research these things, and how a big problem for you guys is really analyzing this data and, like, going next. So what's another obstacle? Like, what's your biggest obstacle throughout your research?
Well, I think my biggest obstacle is most likely just being able to... So when you have data, you want to be able to make models that allow you to understand. So physics is like a wonderful discipline because we have these models that really allow us to understand deeply particular processes, right? You look at, like, you know, Newton's law of motion, laws of motion, for example, right? We really understand what's going on. You can reduce what could be quite a complex set of data to a very simple physical law. And we don't have those kind of laws in when dealing with these sort of large data sets in chemistry or in biochemistry. So it really, the obstacle is trying to take all of this data and sort of see through the noise in order to find that simple physical law. That's really difficult.
Out of all your research projects, which one was the hardest?
I think it was definitely hardest when I was a postdoc. So when I finished, after your PhD, you have this period when you're a postdoctoral researcher, which is, you know, you're trying to sort of discover new science, but you don't yet have a faculty position. And so you have a lot of insecurity. And so at that point, it's difficult because you're very sort of unsure of the future. So things are very insecure. You don't have a lot of job security. So you're trying very hard to do science in a somewhat sort of stressful situation. And it's important at that point, I think, to try and discover new things and sort of be brave and take on difficult problems. But you also want to make sure that you can publish papers and succeed. So there was this problem that I worked on for a long time, which was to do with the relatedness of protein sequences. And I really wanted to understand how that affected our analysis of the data. So it's a little bit tricky to explain, but there was this sort of clear problem with the data that we hadn't taken into account. And I couldn't figure out how we should sort of account for it in our models. And so in the end, it took me over 5 years to figure this out. And it was really my first PhD student who sort of did the hardcore math and simulations that were required to find the answer. So even though I started working on it, you know, before I even moved to Cambridge, it was a long time before we got to the bottom of that one.
So what was your most successful or project you were most proud of?
Well, I think those would have different answers. So the most sort of successful project that I worked on is where we used large sets of protein sequence data to build models that allowed us to predict the 3D structure of the molecule. So proteins are made as a string, a linear string of amino acids, and then they fold up into a particular 3D structure. And predicting that structure has been a big open problem for a long time. It's the protein folding problem. And so people would like to be able to predict sort of the final structure of the protein and also how it folds up. And we couldn't say anything really about how it folds up, but we were able to predict the final structure by analyzing large sets of sequences. And so that was a sort of exciting result. It was interesting because it actually took us a long time to convince people that the result was sort of true and that we weren't somehow, I don't know, conning ourselves, that we could predict these structures and it wasn't really, you know, a prediction. It was more that, you know, people had already done the experiment and so we could sort of cheat in some sense. So it took us quite a long time to convince the community that this was really true, but it was, and that result has sort of had a lot of impact. I think the result that I'm most proud of, so there's this interesting area of mathematics called random matrix theory, which is to do with the sort of theory of matrices or large sets of numbers. And in this case, they're just drawn from random distributions. And I sort of, for a long time, thought that this was interesting and could be applied to the real world in a useful way. And it took a long time for that to sort of become clear and to be somewhat accepted. And so I think that's the thing that I'm most proud of.
If you could give any advice to someone in your position a couple years ago, what would your advice be?
I think my advice would be to keep going. So like, science is not an easy career in any sense. Like, there are lots and lots of setbacks and it's possible to sort of get knocked off the path at any point. And you have to just keep going, even if things aren't easy and even if you don't succeed early on. Tenacity is really important.
So what do your day-to-day operations look like?
Oh my goodness, that is an interesting question. So I actually travel a lot. So I spend a lot of time traveling, which is, I used to really love it and enjoy it. Like, I thought I was really lucky to get to go to all these places. And I still do think that, but it kind of becomes painful after a while. Like, so now it would be really great to just stay in one place more. So travel is a lot of what occupies my time. I also collaborate with people around the world. So I Skype or video conference with people a lot. So that takes up time. And I also Skype or video conference with my students and postdocs, basically talking to people. So I am a little unusual in that I do science a lot by talking to people rather than by sitting there by myself with a pen and paper. And I do that as well, but I actually, it helps me, and I find that I make progress a lot just by interacting with people and talking to them, whether they're students or colleagues or anybody, essentially.
So earlier you talked about how you should complete a paper and that should be your goal after every, you know, research you conduct. How many papers have you conducted, do you know?
No, actually I don't. I should know. I'm really bad at writing papers. It's really boring. So you do science and you find a result and you show that it's true, and that's really exciting. And it's actually kind of a thrill. Like, it's, you sort of get really into it, and but you become obsessed with it, and then finally you realize that something about the world is true. And then honestly, the writing the paper part of it is really boring. So you have to like make yourself sit down and like write it down. You have to write it well so other people will understand, because there's lots of papers out there. So, you know, if your paper isn't interesting and it isn't well written, then people will just ignore it. And it's hard. It takes a lot of time and effort to write things down. And it's really important to do it, but, you know, it's not sort of the most fun part by a long way. And so I try and write as few papers as possible, essentially. I mean, you know, I sort of try and write them when I think we have something that's important and substantial and that we need to communicate it. But yeah, I don't know how many.
You're good.
How long do most of your projects last?
Well, that's a good question. So actually, most of my projects last at least a year. So I tend to work on projects where it takes me a long time to figure out what's going on. And I like to think about them sort of deeply and to try and do something that's significantly different to what people have done before, and that takes a long time. So I would say they take at least a year. Probably most of my projects, there's usually like some fairly long-term research theme going on, you know, in my group at any given point, and there might be two or three such themes, and each theme will last, you know, 3 or 4 years.
So what's the first step of each of your research projects?
Generally, the first step is a data set. So getting hold of a data set that people haven't, you know, sort of understood is not always trivial. And you have to spend a lot of time kind of cleaning the data set up and trying to just look at the data and understand it. It's very easy when you just compute statistics to sort of get some slightly weird statistics because there's like corruption in your data. There are some data points where like the machine broke, or, you know, there was like a smudge on the lens of the camera or the microscope or whatever, right? And so you can sort of like, if you just look at statistics, you can see these sort of interesting things in the data that can turn out to just be noise, essentially. So just be errors or some kind of issues. So spending a lot of time really looking at the data as much as possible and sort of pulling it apart and trying to see, you know, what things should you leave out and what things should really be there. That actually is very time consuming. And then when it seems that you have a good data set, you can start thinking about how to understand it, essentially. So you might cluster the data in various ways, you might compute statistics, you might sort of look at it, you try and visualize it in lots of ways. That's an important part of the problem, of the process. And basically you try and make models. That's a fun part.
So when you're finding your data, how do you minimize the amount of random error, so like human uncertainty?
It's a really good question. That's a huge problem. I would say trying to even see that kind of issue in your data, like batch variation, for example, in experiments, that takes a lot of time and energy and analysis and good students, basically. That's really important because, you know, I can't look at all the data sets that my research group is working on in huge individual data. So I rely on people in my group to do a lot of this work for me. So it's really important that they're really careful. And it's a good question. There's not really a good answer to that question. Basically, you just try as much as possible to look at the data and see issues. But it's really hard.
How many trials do you do for each set of data?
When you say trial, do you mean sort of like for modeling or?
Yeah, like how many times do you repeat a experiment to like get?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as many times as possible. Like having experimental replicates is really valuable, but they're very expensive. So, and convincing your colleagues to collect them is really difficult because, you know, they did the experiment. They don't want to do it again. I mean, So yeah, at least 3 or 4, ideally. It would be great to have more, like 20, 50. That would be fantastic. Yeah. So
what's your favorite part about your job? Is it being a professor? Is it conducting research outside of it? Is it talking to your students?
Definitely my favorite part is still the research. Whether it's I'm doing the research myself or I'm helping the students to do the research, you know, even seeing the students get really excited and kind of obsessed with something and focus on it a lot, that's really gratifying. It's just really fun. It's like a puzzle. You have this puzzle, you have to solve it.
With me today were Lucy Colwell from Cambridge University and Sabrina Turbidy from Aspen High School and Jimena Gutierrez from Glenwood Springs High School. Tune into Radio Physics on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30 for more information about the Gopher program. And these two girls are Gophers. That is, they work here at the center for a week each in the summer. And other events at the center, visit Aspen Center for Physics website at aspenphys.org or give us a call,